Welcome to Counterpoint. I'm Jonathan Judaikin. With me today is James Miller, professor of politics and liberal studies at the New School for Social Research. Miller's work unusually combines publications on the history of rock and roll, as well as renowned studies of intellectual history. His most recent book is called Examined Lives, which will form the basis of the public lecture he will give as part of the Communities in Conversation series at Rhodes College on January 22nd at 6 p.m. in the Bryan Campus Life Center. Jim, it's great to have you on Counterpoint.
Thanks, Jonathan.
Jim, your work teaches us that the ideas and experiences of thinkers cannot be so easily separated. So before we launch into a discussion of your books, help us to understand something about the weave of how they emerge out of your own life story. To give you a skeleton to hang this on, I know that you grew up in Chicago and you got a liberal arts education at Pomona College in California, where in 1967 you wrote your first review for Rolling Stone. That same year, you helped to found a chapter of the Students for a Democratic Society. You went from there to Brandeis, where you did your doctorate. Can you put some flesh and bones on this portrait for us?
Well, obviously, I came of age in the 1960s, and my interests in popular music and in political theory, which may seem odd in 2013, seemed perfectly natural to somebody coming of age in the mid-60s. It was a time of political upheaval in the United States, and for somebody who was coming of age, that upheaval was expressed in part by the kinds of music that people were listening to. I grew up playing popular music, playing rock and roll, as well as listening to it. My father was a professor of English, so I was a faculty brat. Once the family moved to Chicago for my high school years, I was around Hyde Park, the University of Chicago, and came into contact with a number of students, both high school students and college students, who were very politically active in ways that I hadn't experienced before. Up till then, I'd been a kind of a young Democrat and had worked ardently as a 13-year-old to get John Kennedy elected in 1960. In the 1964 campaign, I remember my rock band playing a benefit concert for LBJ. So the interaction of demotic popular culture and the high culture of abstract ideas in the way I lived them in the 60s, they just went naturally together. And as I would subsequently learn from doing research and looking into the backgrounds of some of the other great political theorists who I studied, for example, Rousseau, this was not actually such an unusual kind of experience. There are a number of important thinkers who were simultaneously interested in ideas and in music. Nietzsche's another example.
One thing you didn't talk about in terms of your upbringing, but that you allude to in Examined Lives, is Lutheranism when you were growing up. Was your Lutheran background an important aspect of what shaped your worldview and how you came to see the world as you were coming of age?
Well, my mother was a very observant Lutheran, and yes, as I have remarked on several occasions, in fact, I think I do refer to it in both the introduction and then the epilogue to Examined Lives, I was raised to think that it was very, very, very important to be clear about what you actually believed, what your core convictions were. It was important to have core convictions. It was also important not to feign belief by outward obeisance to certain kinds of rituals and customs, that the way you behave should accord with what your inward beliefs were.
I guess one of the other things you talk about is the intensity of self-examination within the context of that Lutheran upbringing.
Right. Well, I think it's because Lutheranism and Protestantism more generally, it puts an emphasis on simply obeying the law of Christ in this case is insufficient to warrant that you have faith. So that's something that each person has to establish on their own. And you're not really a part of the community of believers until you choose inwardly to join that community. So the question of what you believe is far more important than how you behave outwardly. But once you've chosen a belief, it becomes of paramount importance that you always act outwardly consistently with that belief.
Now, you've already indicated that some of the thinkers that you're interested in, Rousseau and Nietzsche, there was no disconnect for them between an interest in music and an interest in high ideas. But I guess what's different in your case is the connection between high culture and low culture. For many, there may be a disconnect between the two sides of your work. That is, on the one hand, esoteric ruminations of philosophers, and on the other hand, rock music. You once said in an interview with E.J. Dion that pop music and politics all seem to be about the same movement, which for you is that this music was made to change the world. Tell us a little bit about how you see this and what you term rock's cultural essence.
I don't know if rock today has a cultural essence. I think probably not. But back in the 60s, it was widely assumed by a lot of people listening to it that it was about revolt, rebellion, self-expression in ways that weren't codified according to bourgeois norms. You know, that was the milieu that I grew up within in the 60s. But I think that there's a much more mundane way that my interest in rock and roll has connected with the intellectual work that I've done, which is that while I was in graduate school, I was also writing rock reviews for an alternative weekly in Boston, the Real Paper, as well as episodically for Rolling Stone. And at a certain point, I was drawn up short by the fact that here I was this radical historian of ideas who was fascinated with ideas that would change the world and forms of popular culture that would change the world. But when I looked honestly at the stuff I was writing as a graduate student, it was completely indigestible and uninteresting to any normal person. Whereas the whole point of writing about rock and roll in the popular press was to get people excited about music and make them want to listen to it. So there came a time in my mid-20s when I decided I needed to figure out a way to write. I needed to find a literary voice that would permit me to integrate more personal elements and write in a more accessible way about the philosophical ideas that intrigued me, and that to do anything else would be a kind of dereliction of what I took to be my duty to use what skills I had as a writer to communicate to as wide an audience as possible.
And is that partly why you focus a fair bit on biography? I mean, it seems as if that's a tendency that's become more prevalent in your writing. Is it because individual lives enable people to have something to hang more abstract ideas on and give a broader audience a way to connect with those ideas?
Absolutely, because I worked as a journalist. I mean, one of my colleagues at The Real Paper in Boston was Joe Klein. And Joe, when he wanted to write an article that would make people feel outrage about the treatment of some workers who were exposed to toxic chemicals, he would go and tell the story of one or two people who'd become sick because of their exposure to these chemicals. An anecdotal approach is pretty standard in various forms of journalism, and I was living, part of the time at least, among journalists. So I picked up some of those aspects of the journalistic enterprise, and that understanding of what was necessary to grab people emotionally and to stir their imaginations, that was deepened during the decade I spent working at Newsweek magazine. But I have to say, the biographical approach, as I look back on it, I mean, there's a theoretical tie from the beginning. I was fascinated with existentialism, as it was called in the 60s. And in my dissertation, I wrote in part about Jean-Paul Sartre. And in Sartre's first large book, Being and Nothingness, there's a whole chapter on what he calls existential psychoanalysis. And he actually speculates that the only way that you could give a real in-depth interpretation and account of a moment in time was through a study of the experience of a person in all its richness. This is a project he set out to explore in his later books on Flaubert, Genet, etc. There was a theoretical warrant for what I was interested in that went back to how I thought authenticity and existentialism spoke to me in ways that, say, Marxism didn't by itself.
And what I want to do now is give listeners a bit of a sense of the arc of your work more generally, because the people that you've chosen to write about weren't prosaic intellectuals by any stretch of the imagination. If you were writing about musicians who sought to change the world, you also concentrated on writers who didn't just want to interpret the world, but also to change it. To get at the arc of this, there's a clear thread that runs through your first three academic books. As one review of your book on Rousseau put it, in Rousseau, Dreamer of Democracy, Miller has written the logical precursor to his own previous work, History and Human Existence, From Marx to Merleau-Ponty. And the term democracy in the title of the Rousseau book is there also in the title of the third work, Democracy in the Streets, From Port Huron to the Siege of Chicago, which is about the rise and decline of the New Left and the Students for a Democratic Society. So in partly, it's a bit of your own biography there, done generationally. But Give us a sense of what it is about these radicals who forged the modern ideal of democracy that you find so fascinating.
Well, I think, you know, in the 60s, I experienced that era as one of sort of wild hopes and utopian dreams. And I felt electrified by that sense that there was a kind of possibility of reinventing the world from scratch. So I became very fascinated by modern revolutionary moments. I read a lot about the American and the French revolutions, and I read also about the Soviet Revolution, Spanish Civil War, et cetera, et cetera. All this concurrently with my interest in existentialism, which also has an aspect to it that is very Protestant, which you can see clearly, most clearly in Kierkegaard, that in a moment of vision, you can be reborn and become a completely new person from the person you were before. But as time passed, but as I became more aware of the subtleties of actual politics and how power operated, my sense that these kind of utopian romantic possibilities were ready to hand faded. On the other hand, there was a kind of smug complacency that was what I had rebelled against that I found in my liberal adult mentors. And then it was even worse once the new right had arisen on the ash heap of the new left and elected Ronald Reagan. I became more and more concerned to try to preserve somehow in an account of the historical moment in the 60s and how it went, how it could have evolved from a kind of sober effort at social democratic reform into a wildly utopian set of experiments that then devolved into terrorism. And I wanted to convey in a single work, this would be Democracy is in the Streets, both the romance and the catastrophe of a generation ratcheted around, not entirely by its own acts of folly, but often in response to catastrophic events like assassinations and wars in Vietnam and so forth. So to me, the tension between this kind of romantic sense of possible reinvention and conversion and quotidian customary life, that's been a concern I've had really ever since the 70s.
And it seems as if, in fact, this finds its way into your voice. So you've talked a little bit about the way in which a more journalistic approach to things and also writing about pop music helped shape the way in which you write. But when I look across the body of your work, I would also say that one aspect of what animates all of your books is about this romantic sensibility, a kind of new world dawning, revolutionary possibilities and utopias. But oftentimes, viewed retrospectively, one might say by the historian, by what Hegel would call the Owl of Minerva, this kind of now disillusioned perspective that comes from looking backward at a sense of a certain kind of naive idealism, and that part of the way in which your own critical perspective on what you write about comes out is that it's now doused with a certain amount of pragmatism. Do you agree that this is part of your own signature in your writing? And then I guess what I want to do is ask you to reflect on that a little bit more. Is this about your own ambiguities about these revolutionary projects, or does it have something to do with something imminent within these radical adventures themselves, or is it really about the ways in which the world changed that ground those romantic notions to dust in the context of modernity?
Wow. Well, first of all, I think you've pretty accurately summed up one of the tensions that I try to convey in almost all of the books that I've written. One of my models, I should say, was, and very self-consciously, was Hannah Arendt, and in her book On Revolution. She's someone who I greatly admired as a writer. I have, you know, much more complicated feelings for her if one is to treat her as a political philosopher, but that's neither here nor there. And On Revolution, she manages to make come alive key episodes from the American and French Revolution, but she does it in a tone that's entirely elegiac and retrospective as a form of storytelling. And I think she tells these stories in such a way that they're radically open to different readings. When I first read that book, I thought, wow, we should try to behave like the sans-culottes and have little local assemblies and be political participants and bring politics back to life. And my reading of the book was not unusual for student radicals in the 60s who read the book. Now when I read it, I see that actually there's a sense of a lost world that she can keep alive only in the pages of her books rather than through any action she or anybody else could undertake. But the book itself, in the way it's written, is ambiguous and somewhat contradictory and paradoxical. So often what I try to do, and this is the way I have tried to, I guess, emulate that combination, is on the one hand to create descriptions that will impassion and excite readers and make them feel inspired to think about things in a new way and maybe even, you know, go into the world and do things differently. So there's this affect in the narrative. But on the other hand, the analytic apparatus is written in a kind of skeptical cast. So it's kind of working at cross purposes with the narrative. The narrative carries the romantic surge. The analysis becomes an element of restraint. Therefore, different readers reading a book will, if it's been successful, will take entirely different things away from it. Democracies in the Streets has, I know, been read by student radicals since it was first published more than 25 years ago. The slogan, Democracies in the Streets, which wasn't well known in the 60s, was revived in the Battle for Seattle. A lot of the romantic ideas reappeared last year in Occupy Wall Street in 2011. I'm happy with that kind of a reading, but from another angle, the book is a kind of parable about the problems that you encounter if you try to seriously do direct democracy and rule by consensus. And it's an account with one set of people of a set of problems that if I were doing comparative social science, it'd be easy to show that they actually occur over and over again in analogous movements from the Green Movement in Germany in the 70s to Occupy Wall Street 2 years ago. So the book is working in two simultaneous ways, and that's deliberate.
And I guess, I mean, it seems to me this is really very much connected to the critical theory tradition out of which you come. That is, you're simultaneously trying to express both the possibilities as well as the limits of these radical moments and radical thinkers. If you're just tuning in, I'm Jonathan Judaikin, and you're listening to Counterpoint. I'm speaking with James Miller, whose most recent book, Examined Lives, will be the subject of his public lecture, Is the Examined Life Worth Living?, that he'll deliver on January 22nd at 6 p.m. at Rhodes College. Jim, you say that some of the final public lectures that Michel Foucault gave at the Collège de France influenced your book. Foucault's a name that listeners may not recognize, but he was arguably the most famous intellectual in France when he died of AIDS in 1984. And he was the subject of your first foray into biography in your book, The Passion of Michel Foucault, that is a full-throttled biography as opposed to what you did in the Rousseau book. In Examined Lives, you recount the lives and core insights of 12 philosophers, 6 ancient and 6 modern, from Socrates to Nietzsche. I wonder what you might have said about Foucault if you had included him in the book. Can you tell us a little bit about what you might have said about Foucault if you would have included him in the biography Examined Lives?
Well, I'm sure it would have been a condensed version of what I say at much longer length in the Foucault book. I mean, I could actually have included Jean-Paul Sartre in Examined Lives because he's a clear precursor to Foucault, just to take a, you know, 20th century French intellectual who was widely understood by those who admired him to have lived in some ways an exemplary life. So the Foucault book itself is a kind of individualized version of the collective biography in Democracies in the Streets, where we see a person coming of age in the late 40s and 50s being shaped by a certain kind of standardized Hegelian Marxism in the French context, then being swept into the 60s, a little belatedly, and feeling free finally to openly explore his own unusual sexuality, his own taboo up till then interest in hallucinogenic drugs. And this is a person who had always been interested in the extremities of experience, but because of the events of May 68 in France and then his experience when he came to the United States and encountered gay liberation in the Castro in San Francisco, was able to explore it quite openly in his own life. And that ability to explore openly transformed his work from what had been kind of very lyrical protest against the prohibitions and restrictions and punishments typical of modern liberal societies to what became in his last years an obsession with what he called care of the self, which I take to be his own version of self-examination, And I suspect it's because of collective changes that occurred in the course of his lifetime that he was able to make that transition. The drama in the case of his life is the tension in himself between ecstasy and restraint. But I don't want to give any spoilers. People should just go read the book.
But just to expand on this, you say could have written about Foucault, Sartre. There's many others, and you don't actually go into the 20th century. Why is that? Why stop with Nietzsche?
Well, first of all, I'd already written books about other people. I just didn't want to keep going. It's actually the challenge of Examined Lives was to take these philosophers and to treat them now instead of extensively to condense down to brief epitomes of a life and to tell life stories in that way. This was a fairly standard way of recounting lives in antiquity. And it's only really in, you know, the late 19th century that you begin to get these doorstop biographies that are comprehensive. But one of the purposes of the brief life is to create sort of short, almost parable-like narratives that can function as exemplifications, whether positive or negative, for the reader who takes them on board. To write these kinds of condensations, the paradox is you have to do almost as much research as you would to write a doorstop book, or else it'll just be garbage. So I felt like once I got to Nietzsche, I'd set the table for the 20th century characters. And I had one token professor, who's Kant, who most modern philosophers are professors, although not all. Sartre was not a professor, but Bergson was, and Foucault actually was. However unconventional a professor he nevertheless was a university professor. And Nietzsche starts out as a university professor, and then he basically says, no, this is, I can't do this. So it seemed to me that, yes, I could have carried it forward. There were other people I had thought about including that I ended up not including. I at one time wanted to include Karl Marx, who seems to me actually quite relevant to the project of the book. Spinoza's relevant. But it took me years to do the 12 I did, and I decided to call a halt and move on to another project.
Well, I have to say that the effort was eminently worthwhile because they're absolutely extraordinary distillations, and you can see the scholarship that goes into each chapter as well as the craft in boiling a life down to the moments that do make it exemplary. So one of the reasons you're saying that you exclude the 20th century is because much of philosophy now takes place in the context of the academy, and really what you wanted to do was focus on philosophical lives that were worth emulating. And as you've already suggested, what Examined Lives does is to resuscitate this ancient genre, whereby one learned about philosophical precepts by reading the story of the life of the philosophical preceptor. In doing so, you operate according to the maxim of Nietzsche, who said, "The only critique of a philosophy that is possible and that proves something is to see whether one can live in accordance with it." Jim, give us a bit of an overview of your approach in Examined Lives and how you treat each of the 12 figures that you discuss.
Well, the book had to begin with Socrates because as I was doing the research on it, it became clear to me that the notion of the philosopher is really an invention of Plato using a fictional version of Socrates as the embodiment of this new character, the philosopher. Before Plato, there were sages and teachers. They were actually called sophists. The notion of a philosopher, as it appears in Plato, is someone who yearns for knowledge, longs for wisdom, which may or may not be attainable, actually. So there's a gap between what one desires and what one actually possesses. It's a tradition that emerges in Athens in the period really from Socrates to Aristotle. And there's a large number of what become paradigmatic philosophers, almost all of whom are trying to imitate Socrates, rather the way early Christians would try to imitate Christ. These early followers of Socrates very quickly branched out into what became understood in antiquity as different schools of philosophy, and each of the schools had a characteristic set of teachings, but also a characteristic ways of life, and one way that you could learn about the way of life was by recounting stories and legends about the founder of the school. So the first part of Examined Lives is really just laying out that early terrain by looking at Socrates, then looking at Plato and taking very seriously his misadventures with a variety of ancient tyrants, very powerful political leaders that he was fascinated by. looking at Diogenes the Cynic, who in some ways is the anti-Plato and lived at roughly the same time as Plato, looking at Aristotle, who was much more successful as an advisor to tyrants and was really reviled by the people of Athens because he was a Macedonian and seen as an occupier. From there, the book sort of jumps forward to look at Roman Stoicism through the case of Seneca, who was controversial in antiquity because some people thought he was a great philosopher and other people thought he was a monumental hypocrite. And we're beginning to get into a period where we have multiple historical sources rather than only primarily fictional legendary sources. And from there, it goes to Augustine, the famous Christian theologian, who's inspired by Platonic ideas and tries to live a perfect life and works through a number of different versions of what that might be and ends up converting from Platonic philosophy to Christianity. When I come to the moderns, I wanted to start with the two people who I think really represent the break with this tradition. One is Montaigne, who tries to live an examined life by writing down everything he's actually thinking and feeling, but then discovers that what he actually thinks and feels can't be fit into any of the exemplary models he's been taught. And at a certain point, he just gives up on trying to imitate other people and tries just to be his own natural self. And that creates a whole new understanding of self-identity or authenticity that becomes very consequential for modern thinkers. The other great breaking point is Descartes, who has been taught by Jesuits to live an exemplary Christian life. He has a kind of counter-reformation sense of self-examination, which appears in his discourses, and yet the upshot of his philosophy is a very abstract set of mathematical, geometric, and physical propositions. And you can begin to see the bifurcation between philosophy as a science and philosophy as a way of life that marks all subsequent philosophy. From there, I went and looked really primarily at people who tried to follow philosophy as a way of life. Jean-Jacques Rousseau was very influenced by both Descartes and Montaigne. Rousseau, in turn, influenced Kant, but Kant was a professor and was torn between the notion of himself being an exemplary human being and the importance he placed on his treatises and his abstract ideas. And from there, I turned to Emerson, mainly because I'm an American, and, you know, philosophy we sometimes think is sort of foreign to the United States, but Emerson is America's great philosopher to me, and he very much held himself out as an exemplary person to his audience. And then Nietzsche, who, among other things, was influenced by all of the ancient philosophers I begin with, but also by Emerson.
And so in each case with this pantheon, as it emerges, what you're exploring is this notion of philosophy as a way of life. And as the pantheon develops, it seems that what counted in order to be included, and again, you've already said there could have been others who were included, but is a process of intensive and self-conscious self-examination that you said Foucault termed in one of his lost books, the care of the self, all with the goal of self-realization and insights about how to live. That's why we turn to philosophers. But in the epilogue, you end on a somber note, writing, "For anyone hoping for happiness or political wisdom or salvation, philosophical self-examination seems in practice to have led to self-doubt and as often as self-trust, to misery as often as joy, to reckless public acts as often as prudent political conduct, and to moments of self-inflicted torment as often as moments of saving grace." If this is true, Jim, why bother with the book? Or to put it another way, is philosophy perhaps something to be avoided rather than indulged, as the parents of so many young philosophy students suggest?
Well, that's a good question, but now I suppose the real answer to that goes back to the questions you were asking me about how I was raised. And as I also say in the epilogue, I felt, and I still feel, that I have really no choice but to choose to examine myself. And that's a kind of paradoxical situation to find oneself in, although I don't think it's that unusual in cultures that have certain norms of introspection and self-awareness. And certainly most educational institutions continue to strive to inculcate some of these self-reflective skills in students, sometimes under the rather wan rubric of critical thinking. The thing I wanted to get across, though, is that in antiquity, it's just sort of taken for granted that if you lived a good life, you might be in a better position to enjoy happiness, tranquility, you might be wiser in how you exercise political power. I think what's happened is that as in the modern period, when people have embarked on an odyssey of self-exploration, they've gone really deep and they've gone far beyond the kind of plaster saint stories that we're familiar with if we go back to Plato's dialogues and the figure of Socrates that we find there, or even Augustine, who is more three-dimensional in the Confessions. But it's a far cry from the kind of tormented personality we find on display in the pages of Rousseau's Confessions or of Nietzsche's letters and notebooks. What it actually means to go deep sea diving in yourself, it's very tough, it's very hard. And I think in a certain sense, I wanted the book to seem exciting that people went on these adventures, interior adventures. But at the same time, you know, I could have put a little sticker on each volume saying, kids, don't try this at home by yourself. But to be serious rather than simply facetious, what's at stake in part, in some case, somebody like Nietzsche or even Foucault, is can you undertake a successful self-analysis? Freud, as we know, thought he could do it, but nobody else could, and that the only safe way to do it was in a community among friends, et cetera, et cetera. And that's why so many of the ancient schools, I think, were functioning as communities of friends and literal schools in which restraints were put on the most abandoned explorations of the inner self, because that is a kind of romantic rabbit hole in itself. So it requires some kind of restraint and sobriety and a few warning signs before you go down the hole.
And I guess it also requires community. And in some senses, you're suggesting the odyssey of self-exploration is inevitable. Many of us assume that we begin that odyssey as unique and completely original individuals. And at least one aspect of taking the journey alongside examined lives is to show us that many of the ideas that we think are uniquely our own, in fact, have been inherited from this long Western philosophical tradition that you helped to carve out. And for that, James Miller, thank you so much for helping us to understand this in a deeper way today on Counterpoint.
Well, thank you for having me on.
Putting a spotlight on the role of scholars, academics, and intellectuals, and how their work illuminates the issues we face locally and globally, Counterpoint is a monthly broadcast on WKNO-FM. To listen to this show in its entirety, visit WKNOFM.org and click on the news menu item, where you'll find a link to Counterpoint. You can podcast Counterpoint by visiting iTunes and searching for WKNO Counterpoint. Counterpoint is a production of WKNO-FM in association with the Spence L. Wilson Chair in Humanities at Rhodes College. Justin Willingham produces the show. I'm Jonathan Judaikin. Thanks for listening. We'll be right back.